There's a really fantastic image from the early 17th century of a farmer planting his fields, but he's not spreading seeds on them. He's spreading gold. And it's like a metaphor that works doubly. Your agriculture is your financial success, but also being a farmer is like being an alchemist.
Science Social, a podcast series about how science, history, and society connect with and add to the big questions that we all have today. This show is created by the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. My name's Stephanie Hood, and in each episode, I'm joined by a guest from our institute to talk about their research, their big questions, and some of the weird and wonderful experiences they've had along the way. Today, I'm with Justin Nehemiah Jahoney, who's an assistant professor of the History of Science and Medicine at the Florida Institute of Technology. He's also a former postdoctoral fellow from the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, where he was based in Department 3, Artifacts, Action, Knowledge. Justin specialized in the history of early modern alchemy as a method of agricultural reform. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you very much.
So what I have here is a little bit of information about global food demand issues that are happening right now. So global population is increasing, expected to rise to 9.7 billion by 2050. And according to a meta-analysis by Nature that was published last year, global food demand is expected to increase significantly over the next 30 years. And that's going to require a lot more space. It's going to require a lot more agricultural land. There are plenty of occasions in history where food provision was in crisis and solutions were sorely needed. This is not the only time that we've experienced this. And in the early modern era, agriculture was also facing diverse challenges. Can you describe the crisis situation or those issues for us?
So the kind of the long 17th century in Europe and really across much of the world used to be described by historians and are still described by historians as the general crisis. There are just lots of bad things going on during this time period that include famines and food dearths. They include lots of conflicts are happening during this time. We know one of the most destructive wars in Europe happens in the early 17th century, the 30 Years' War. And in Britain, which is the area that I mostly focus on, you also have the civil wars. And due to the Little Ice Age, there's a natural phenomenon that leads to lower temperatures, particularly across the northern hemisphere, that leads to major problems with food production in Europe in the 16th and the 17th century. So this leads in a lot of locations to what some scholars refer to as the dearth sciences, which is this essentially attempting to understand in a systematic way why famines happen at a natural level and what they can do to sort of ameliorate those sorts of things. With the 17th century being the time in Europe when the scientific revolution really takes off, there's a reform movement that becomes sort of very dominant in the middle of the 17th century. That is, how do we turn agriculture into a science the same way that we're trying to do with other sorts of sciences, astronomy, botany, all these other things?
You use the word science. Was it seen as science?
They use the word sciences often to speak to the plurality and the discrepancies between various types of sciences. I tend to usually be okay using that word, at least in part because they're using that word. If you want to maybe dig deeper into that, of course, the 17th century is also an era where natural philosophy or philosophia naturalis gets, this is the concept of approaching nature in a way that tries to understand it observationally or experimentally. There are people who we would consider, and I think most historians of science would consider, natural philosophers that are all involved in these sorts of things. Robert Boyle, for instance, is very much involved with reform movements around sort of making seeds sprout more quickly and to make crops grow more densely. But there are also people who I think we wouldn't think of as natural philosophers who are also involved in this sort of thing. And those are people who are simply landowners who are educated and they have a sort of basic knowledge of what we would think of as chemistry or botany, and they're not university people.
Okay, that's really interesting. I'm actually going to come back to a couple of those points later, especially about local people being, if and how they were involved. So I'm going to go a little bit back to your general research area. Or also, one question I really want to ask you actually is, what inspired you to do this research?
Huge question, right? Yeah. you know, it's funny. I mean, if I'm looking at this from like the standpoint right now, I've been considering myself kind of like a historian of alchemy for the last several years. And if anything, I feel like that's not quite what I am now. I almost feel like I'm a historian of local ecologies and material cultures and the ways that people have tried to engage with their environment at a both practical and ethical level. But when I started graduate school, I didn't think I was going to do anything like this at all. I actually started out working on astrology. And I had some really great guidance, I think, at the beginning of graduate school, mainly because, you know, we live in a time where we have just exceptional power over the natural world in both sort of good and bad ways. And trying to get to the root of that, trying to understand how people have decided, you know, what the proper way to engage with the natural world is, particularly in the era of climate change, particularly in the Anthropocene. I mean, that just became like a question that needed answering. And as a historian, you know, my natural instinct was, you know, well, we got to look several hundred years in the past to sort of answer those questions. And for maybe a final answer to that, I come from a family of farmers. Both of my grandfathers were farmers. I lived on a farm for the first few years of my life. We stopped raising cattle when I was younger. I think it got to be too much. So, I mean, like, I feel like all of those things sort of combined into a way that I could put sort of a professional spin on a lot of those multiple interests and kind of combined those all into one unholy ball of interesting
things. Or extremely holy ball of interest. Circling back to more terminology, I think we all kind of have a tacit sense of what you mean by agriculture, but mm-hmm. alchemy, I think, is something that we mm-hmm. have a very specific understanding of, perhaps as historians of science, mm-hmm. maybe also from other disciplines. Could you explain in your own words what alchemy is?
Sure. The standard definitions of alchemy, I guess, really in the Western world from the Middle Ages up through the early 18th century, when it sort of starts to be replaced by what we think of as chemistry, is an engagement with material substances in which you are intending to transform one substance into another substance. The classic example of this, of course, is transmuting lead into gold. And alchemists believe that they could sort of accomplish this in the laboratory using what's usually referred to as the philosopher's stone, which is not an actual stone. It's another substance that, depending on the school of alchemy, might be anything from mercury to vitriol to saltpeter or some other substance, immaterial substance, that aids you in making that transformation. And it's related to a lot of different fields, metallurgy, botany. There are other aspects of it that relate to medicine. So, for example, the elixir of life is another sort of very common goal of alchemists, to create this substance that was supposed to prolong human life or possibly even extend it indefinitely. So it's a chemical activity. It's an activity that is engaged with chemical and metallic substances, and it's experimental. That's the other important part of it. But even the word alchemy, as used in 17th century English, is kind of a controversial subject in itself. What we think of as alchemy and what we think of as chemistry, that was one thing in the 17th century. And in fact, they had a word for that, and it was chemistry. It was just spelt with a Y, C-H-Y-M instead of C-H-E-M. And a lot of scholars of the history of alchemy and chemistry have started to use that word in place of either alchemy or chemistry with an E, specifically because they don't want to differentiate those two things in the early modern period. And it is, in fact, the process of those things becoming distinguished at the beginning of the 18th century that gives us our modern notion of alchemy today.
Okay, great. That's a fun fact. I like that. And that actually leads perfectly into my next question. That was really fascinating. You threw in some great buzzwords as well, like the philosopher's stone and the elixir of life. Now I really would like to know, how did the idea come up to use alchemy for agriculture?
So this is actually, there are a number of kind of ways of looking at this. I'll tell you specifically about my research. Again, there are different schools of alchemical thought, and most of the different schools rely on what substance is it that you're going to use to try to transform other substances. You have Neoplatonists, which are these sort of this philosophical school that comes out of the Renaissance, and they're arguing that there is something called a vital spirit, a spiritus vitalis, that is a kind of enlivening spirit that exists in all matter. And they start to suggest that there are different substances in which you could sort of find a distilled version of that. By the 16th century, alchemists start to run with this idea, and they start doing experiments, essentially attempting to find this vital spirit. And one of the substances that they sort of settle on is what they called a vegetable salt. And based on the experiments that they're doing, what we might think of as potassium nitrate or saltpeter. And so there's this new school of thought that starts to develop in the middle of the 16th century, what's known as the Salnitrum school, the salt niter school, in part because the substance of saltpeter, if you dissolve it in water and if it gets dissolved into the soil, potassium and nitrogen come out of it. And these are two of the most important ingredients in fertilizers, right? And through various experiments, lots of people come to realize in the second half of the 16th century, that this substance that alchemists had been using in an attempt to create the Philosopher's Stone also had lots of applications for making plants grow. And this leads to various theories that just like metals might be changed from one form into another, perhaps we can do the same thing with soils. Perhaps we can do the same thing with plants in the same way that an alchemist in the laboratory might be able to make one metal change. We might be able to take infertile soil with these sorts of substances and make them fertile in the same way that we might be able to multiply. This is a word that they use all the time, multiplicatio, the idea that we can multiply gold into more gold. Maybe seeds act the same way.
That's also a beautiful segue to one of my next questions. Okay, so what I'm going to do is first I'd like to ask you about the people in general that were involved in this, and then I want to ask a little bit more about the farmers, but let's start with like more macro people involved. So what kind of people were particularly concerned with this agricultural crisis and with finding solutions? What might their mindset have been like, and how did they view nature?
So most of these people were, I guess, what we would think of as kind of a middle social level people. They're not wealthy, they're not aristocrats, but it's also not the sort of regular everyday tenant farmers who we're talking about here. It is landowners and it is yeoman farmers, not always necessarily big plantation owners, just people who sort of own their own plots of land and who have sort of developed a kind of basic chemical education. So the middle of the 17th century, there's a group of people known as the Hartlib Circle. And this is a kind of correspondence group that grows up around a Prussian emigre to England, Samuel Hartlib. He actually fled the 30 Years' War. And he develops this massive network of scholars around him where correspondences kind of flow back and forth. And lots of correspondence is based in German-speaking territories in Northern Europe and also in North America. And these people become kind of, I don't want to paint them with too broad a brush because they're a very diverse group of people, but many of them are absolutely obsessed with this notion of agrarian reform. They see it sort of ripe for this idea, what they call improvement. Improvement is a word that gets used constantly in agricultural manuals and agrarian documents and these sorts of things. So one example of an idea that comes out of the Hartlib Circle is from a person named Benjamin Worsley. Benjamin Worsley is a physician, and he actually worked as an army physician during the English Civil Wars. And he has this notion that, and we talked about saltpeter earlier as a sort of chemical substance that became associated with fertility, that became associated with the potential for artificial fertilizers. And he comes up with these ideas basically to try to create saltpeter, which had been used for gunpowder. There are all of these sort of manufacturing plants for gunpowder production in England. Over the course of the 1630s, 40s, 50s, the English East India Company starts to import saltpeter from India in a way that means that these artificial plants are not really necessary anymore. So he is trying to sort of reappropriate these things in agriculturally productive ways. And one sort of almost like really bonkers idea that he has is to kind of create a self-sustaining, like almost perpetual motion machine of saltpeter production by having laborers live where they work and actually using their feces and their urine to kind of continuously create saltpeter at these locations specifically to use. Yes, it sounds very, very disgusting, but this is the notion that as long as we keep the workers there, then this will just keep going on forever and ever and ever. But I should say that, you know, these, you look at some of the really big things that the Hartlib Circle members wanted to do, and almost none of them come to fruition. Small level ones do, though. John Beale has some very successful grafting experiments that allows him to graft different types of apple trees. So you can find success stories in the
You've already mentioned one or two solutions that were proposed, alchemical solutions to agricultural problems. Could you maybe give me one or two other examples?
Sure. There's a really great manuscript document from the University of Glasgow, and it's 5 pages. It's called Vegetani. It's got a little quasi pseudo-Latin title, but it's a single alchemical recipe for creating, I've been calling them saltpeter balls, but they never actually name what they are. But it is a very lengthy sort of procedure that requires using an alembic, which is a distilling device, and the use of multiple ingredients, including sort of very easy to procure ingredients on a farm like sheep's dung and urine, but also some more alchemical ingredients, including not just saltpeter, but also things like vitriols and these metallic sulfates. And they all get mixed together. They get put in this alembic. You're supposed to distill it, and then you bring the liquid that gets caught up in the top of the alembic and then gets dropped down. And then that solidifies and crystallizes. And you have basically what they saw as this ball of like concentrated nitrate material that you could then either melt into water and then spray on your fields, or you could walk around after you've planted things and sort of like crumble it into a powder and then put it in your fields. But we don't know who wrote this. This is an entirely anonymous document. It's from the very end of the 17th century. But based on these step-by-step procedures, it is highly likely that this was used on farms, that this was something that was done from what we would say from the modern perspective to add nitrates to and potassium to the soil as a way of fertilizing. And one of the more interesting things about this document is that we also have evidence that things like this, things just like almost this exact recipe, is still used in the 21st century in places like Burundi.
What were the underlying goals or aims of increasing agricultural production? I mean, was it purely for the public good? Was there also a financial interest in increasing production?
It's both. They're absolutely in it for economic gain. But again, most of them are sort of these good Baconians. And part of the Baconian program is that science is meant for public good, and improvement itself, it applies not just to the sciences, it applies to the social, and it applies to good governance too. And they very much see the improvement of agriculture as the foundation of what would eventually be an improvement in governance. Essentially, you can't have a state that responds to the needs of everybody if you can't feed everybody. And so they very much see the role of the sort of chemically educated agrarian improver as a way to create something, you know, that is on the way to a kind of Baconian utopia, basically.
The farmers or the workers on the field, how do they welcome this involvement or not?
Yeah, this is a million-dollar question in my work. We spend a lot of time looking at agrarian manuals. These are written, published documents that are basically telling farmers how to do certain sorts of things with the soil or with water or with irrigation. We really do not know to what degree the people that are writing these things are describing what are actually happening on farms, or they are telling farmers what they need to do. I've tended to come down more on the side of, you know, everyday farmers are just kind of, they see a lot of this as kind of, you know, nuts. Like, come on, we've been farming for centuries. I learned from my father. My father learned from his grandfather, you know, whatever. This is nuts. But at the same time, we do have some evidence that some of these fertilizing techniques, in fact, do boost crop yields. And so, for example, there is a farmer in Herefordshire, which is in Western England, named John Beale, and he has this massive apple orchard. And he left behind a lot of documents, but we know from the way that he talks about his employees that he is himself conducting a number of experiments with seeds and with grafting. And he'll write things like, my laborers discovered X, Y, or Z, you know, while they were doing a certain grafting technique. So we do know that those people are doing those sorts of things, but it's they're probably closer to what Stephen Chapin called the invisible technicians, these individuals about whom we know very, very little, or we only know about them through people who are sort of their social superiors.
I mean, I could probably guess the answer to this because 17th century, were any women involved in this process of this marrying in a way of alchemy and agriculture?
Yes, especially at the stage of what we might call plant husbandry. There are quite a few examples of women, especially, it's oftentimes the wives of the men who are doing that in the agricultural fields, that either use the plants that have been created through these alchemical processes for medical purposes, or they're using their own sort of knowledge of chemistry to create medical chemical solutions to stop plant diseases. And we know this from a lot of the, again, recipe books. And I mean recipe in a very broad sense. I mean, that would have included everything from food recipes to alchemical recipes. And women are also the ones that end up collecting these into handbooks. So we have a lot of that evidence because of that.
Okay. That connects really well to one of our podcast episodes, because we had a podcast with Elaine Leong.
I was just going to say, Elaine Leong has written all about that. You should absolutely look at her work to see those sorts of things.
For sure. And listen to our podcast. Maybe one little thing. I mean, it goes more into that direction of that particular episode, but where did women get that knowledge that they were putting into recipe books or these informational handbooks?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I assume it's experience. I'm a big proponent of the kind of Deborah Harkness way of looking at 16th and 17th century English science, which is that it's absolutely a kind of maker's knowledge, and women were the doers of that time period. I mean, they're absolutely the most involved in sort of the day-to-day management of a household or of a farm even. So the men are often the ones writing things down, but it's clear from their own writings that it's the women that are doing a lot of this. I think there are more manuscript documents that we can find that have been written by women, but so much of the documents that I look at are from the Hartlib Circle, and there are very few women who have written for him.
Difficult. Yeah. One question I would like to ask you actually is rather along the lines of, I mean, for example, how from today might we see ethically some of the processes or solutions, alchemical solutions that were used in agriculture?
Right. In the 17th century, at least, the ethical context of all of this relates to what are sometimes referred to as, and I'll use some terminology from religious environmental ethics here, what are sometimes called the dominion thesis of human engagement with the natural world and the stewardship thesis. And these come directly out of readings of Genesis, and they're brought up constantly in the 17th century. One of them is the dominion thesis is this notion that humanity, by God's command, has dominion over the birds in the air and the fish in the sea and everything that's on the ground. And that is used as an excuse, essentially, for we can do whatever we want with the natural world. There are other people in the 17th century that say, okay, we'll keep reading, because in the next chapter, God also commands humanity to be stewards of the land and that we have to take care of it. Now, no matter which sort of ethical position you take, these are going to be anthropocentric. The human is at the center. If you fast forward to the 21st century, those are still the terms of the debate, I think. Whether you're sort of within that religious tradition or not, you can draw very close parallels between the way that they're thinking about that question in the 17th century and the way that I think environmentally we're thinking about these sorts of things in the 21st.
That's great. You actually almost kind of integrated one of the other questions I wanted to ask you, which is, I think in my experience, the utility on a wider kind of macro scale of the history of science is something that historians of science are grappling with increasingly more and more. In your eyes, how and why can or why should history of science inform current issues?
One of the ways that I was sort of taught very early in graduate school also was, you know, do not be a presentist. Like, one of the worst things that you can do as a historian is like try to seek validation for a particular, you know, political preference or for a particular way of very specifically understanding the modern world by looking for a so-called origin in the past, which I still think that that's like a mistake. But I also agree with this notion that you'll sometimes hear people say that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And, you know, we are currently very much in a rhyming period with the way that we are dealing with environmental issues that I think resonates just a great deal when you look at the 17th century, because it's understanding particularly the kind of practical and ethical questions that early modern reformers of agriculture who were interested in using alchemy or chemistry to do these sorts of things, they are asking the same types of questions, I think, that people who are interested in potentially geoengineering the entire planet today are asking. And that is essentially, you know, to what degree does power over nature mean that we have a responsibility for it? And, you know, I think a lot of environmentalists today are wrestling with that question where, you know, climate change is happening right now, and there are things that we can do to mitigate those things now. Almost all of those require another engagement with nature, right? It's not as if we can just sort of like step back and say, all right, we're going to let nature do its thing now. Like, that's just not going to happen in a modern industrial society. So any solutions that we sort of develop for modern day problems are going to involve technoscience. And again, this is what in the 17th century, they're also asking. Many of the people that I study, they consider themselves followers of Francis Bacon. They consider themselves Baconian in the sense that they see themselves as sort of being sanctioned both by God and by their own ingenuity to be able to and to have the right to become engaged very directly in nature. And science is the tool that is used to investigate that.
What would you say we can learn from their perspectives, solutions, and approaches for challenges surrounding food production and food security today? And Would you say there are approaches that are being or that may be used in the future that are comparable to their approaches?
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, since most of them are such ardent followers of Bacon, you know, one of the things that Bacon says is that nature to be commanded must be obeyed. You know, they see the world, the natural world, as manipulable in certain ways, but they're fully aware that nature itself can't sort of just, there's no possible way for humans to gain full sort of control or mastery over that. So I think, I mean, if you want to look at just a very broad way of thinking about it, we should be much more humble in the 21st century about what humans can and should do with the natural world. And I mean, when it comes to food production, of course, we're living in the era of industrial agriculture. We're living in the era of chemical industrial agriculture, I mean, for the past 100 and 140 years. And it's we have to think about those in both the sort of positive and negative terms. I mean, of course, without things like the Haber-Bosch process and the development of certain types of synthetic fertilizers, I mean, we could not have fed the extra billion people that come into being in the 20th century. But at the same time, we're dealing with extraordinarily difficult ecological repercussions of these sorts of things where you have phosphorus runoff and nitrogen depletion and soil erosion. These are all consequences of modern industrial agriculture. So I think trying to understand the balance between how do you feed 8 billion people and also make sure that you don't destroy the very thing by which you're going to feed billions of people into the future. Mm-hmm. And that's very Baconian too, right? Because again, Bacon's a utopian and the people, well, he's sort of a utopian. And many of the people who follow them see themselves as engaged in this process where they're literally trying to make lives better for other people. And science is at the core of that.
Cool. Got some really great concrete examples of this podcast.
That's what I was hoping for.
This is it for today. If you like what you just heard, we'd love your support. Click the subscribe button, recommend us to your friends and colleagues, or give us a thumbs up in your favourite podcast app. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere else you can listen to podcasts. Science Social is produced by the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. Music by Poddington Bear, and I'm the host, Stephanie Hood. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at @MPIWG. And most of all, thanks for listening.